we have to imagine this world we need to be rushing towards. We're not going to get there as urgently as we need to unless we actually want to. And of course we need to want to, because it's going to be a much healthier world. We're going to have lovely greening of cities. We're going to have these new jobs that are going to be so much better. We're going to hear the birds singing. We're going to have a more equal world. We can't get there fast enough.
Hello and welcome back to Season 2. I'm your host, Adam Met, and today we're kicking it off by talking with Christiana Figueres, the key architect of the Paris Climate Agreement, and Mary Robinson, the former President of Ireland and UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. Christiana began her public service career in the Costa Rican Embassy of West Germany, and then moved into the climate sector when she founded the Center for Sustainable Development in the Americas. In 2010, she was appointed Executive Secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, where she constructed the Paris Climate Agreement, which pledged to lower carbon emissions and heighten climate resilience. 196 governments signed on at the end of 2015. From 1990 to 1997, Mary was the seventh president of Ireland, being the first woman to hold the role. During her term, she elevated human rights in the country, notably decriminalizing homosexuality and increasing access to contraceptives. Just after, she became the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, a role dedicated to improving the lives and protections of each and every individual, from the international to the local level. She now sits as the Chair for the Elders, a collection of human rights advocates brought together by Nelson Mandela in 2007. The three of us talk about communicating climate stories, sustaining optimism, and coordinating a movement with corporations, organizations, and individuals. You can find them both on their own podcasts, Mary on Mothers of Invention, and Christiana on Outrage and Optimism. A quick reminder that we're planting a tree for every person who subscribes to this podcast, so make sure to hit that subscribe button. And without further ado, here is Christiana Figueres and Mary Robinson on Planet Reimagined. Thank you both so much for being here today. Both of you are incredible inspirations for me. And one of you in particular is the person who inspired me to start studying what I'm studying. So, Mary, you don't know this, but over a decade ago, when I was in high school, I went on a class trip to see you speak at Ethical Culture in New York City, and you were giving a talk. And that moment, hearing you speak, was the moment that convinced me to start studying human rights. And so I studied it for my undergrad, for my master's, and now for my PhD. So first of all, I wanted to thank you for being here today.
Wow.
Because you have been my inspiration.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that. It's always nice to hear that something you said inspired somebody else to really go deeply into a subject. That's great.
Amazing. So
Adam, can I pile in on admiration for Mary right here at the start?
Of course.
Because Mary, I don't know if I have ever told you this, but you were the first person who talked to me about the link between human rights and climate change when I was a very, very newly minted executive secretary at the United Nations Framework Convention Secretariat. And I was at my very first big New York meeting. I think it was a GA, General Assembly. And you asked to meet with me. And I thought, I wonder why Mary Robinson, who works on human rights, why does she want to talk to me when I'm working on climate change? And you sat me down and you educated me in 45 minutes with the most compelling, clear, crystal, piercing arguments. And I went, that's it. I don't need to talk to anybody else. I'm done. She's educated me. I'm convinced. I am following it. So there you go, Mary. That's the impact that you have on people.
Well, it's kind of nice to hear, but I was a very late comer to climate change. You know, I spent my 5 years as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, and I knew that there was another part of the UN dealing with climate, the Climate Convention, and I didn't make the connection to human rights. It was afterwards, working in African countries on economic and social rights, that, you know, literally my eyes were opened in a very humiliating way, you know, a humbling way, that I had missed it. And so I'm a latecomer in that sense to the connection, but once I got it, I really got it.
That's incredible. And I want to go into a lot of detail about the relationship between human rights and climate, but I want to ask you a few, you know, more surface questions first so the audience can really get to know you. I want to ask about communication, because both of you are incredible communicators and you both work in fields that are incredibly technical and complex. So when you're talking to a wider audience, how do you work out whether you're going to talk about the complexity of issues, but also balance it with making it clear and simple and also actionable for many people around the world?
Well, if you're asking me, I think the best approach is to tell stories. Stories that really move people and make it real to them. And that's why I wrote a book about climate justice, hope, resilience, and the fight for a sustainable future. And there are 11 stories, 9 of them happen to be about women, but there are also 2 good men. And it was to bring home the climate issue. And then I still wasn't happy, so I decided I wanted to make a documentary. And I went and got very good advice, which was, no, you're not the right person to make a documentary, and it takes too long anyway, and so on. Why don't you do a podcast? And I'm an elder, and I asked the stupid question, well, what's a podcast? And that led me to Mothers of Invention. But I do think you communicate with a story that people will really open up to, you know.
And so, Christiana, do you agree that stories are the right way of communicating about these issues?
I totally agree with the person who I have come to know as Mama Mary, because she's such a mother figure to so many of us. I totally agree that telling stories is important because it humanizes the topic, right? It takes it out of the gigatons and the yearly reports and all of this, and it humanizes, it brings it much closer to who we are as people. I also think that it's important to contextualize communication. And that's why it was really important that Mary asked before we started this conversation, who's the audience, right? Because depending on who the audience is, that is the message or those are the stories that you share. So just to illustrate that, if I am in conversation with a group of investors, then I will bring, you know, my numbers to the table and I will make the argument why renewable energy is actually a much better investment than investing in coal. I don't bring them a moral argument because many of them may have, you know, moral convictions, but that's not why they're in the room. If I'm in conversation with members of any spiritual community, then I don't necessarily have to bring numbers to the table, right? Then it really is about human rights, about protection of our planet. It's a very different conversation. Now, the wonderful thing about climate and about development is that there are many paths, but it all ends up in the same place. Many different paths to the same truth. But it's important to choose the path of communication or to choose the examples and the stories according to who you're in conversation with.
That's incredible. And both of you mentioned talking to specific audiences and tailoring the way you're communicating to these audiences. And both of you have podcasts. And podcasts have become such a ubiquitous way of communicating messages to different audiences. But there's something unique about both of you in that you are both celebrities in your field and even beyond your field. From having your podcasts to being featured in documentaries and creating documentaries to having the TED platform. I want to know a little bit about how being a celebrity has impacted your ability to continue working in policy and research, but also on the communication side.
I don't actually think of myself as a celebrity.
No, neither do I.
I really don't. You know, I know that I'm reasonably known to certain audiences, yes. But it has never really impacted on me. In fact, I think of celebrities as being in the film world and the pop world. I don't think of myself as a celebrity, so it doesn't really affect me at all.
I would agree with that. I don't think of myself as that. Like Mary, I know that there's some name recognition in certain circles, not everywhere. And it's in those circles that are closer to the topics that we both work on. And it's much more the conviction that we have started here a job, but we definitely haven't finished. And that we cannot just sort of give up now or walk away when the job is only halfway done. So it's very much more of a passion, of a dedication, and a conviction that we can make a difference, all of us together, rather than stepping up on any celebrity platform.
Do you think that the kinds of audiences that you are reaching above and beyond your policy peers means something to your policy peers? So when you go back into a meeting that's policy focused and they know that you've had platforms like TED and like your podcast and like your books, do you think they look at you differently because you have this wider audience?
I think it is helpful to engage with a much wider audience. And what I have really enjoyed in the last few years is the intergenerational discussion, because it has changed from my time, if I could put it that way. My time is quite a long time ago. And, you know, what we did was we listened to our elders with deep respect and usually pretty silently and absorbed their wisdom. It was a one-way track. And that was the way both sides thought of it. And that has so changed. And now we have young, bright climate activists, and they can be 14, 15, 16, and I've learned from them. They're so digital, they're so connected, they make such links, but they also see themselves as kind of citizens of the world in a way that's really encouraging. And they care deeply about those who are worse off and suffering more. I'm talking particularly about the climate issue, than they are. And there's a sort of generosity of spirit that helps me to re-energize.
I totally agree with Mary. I don't think either of us use podcasts or books or whatever to impress policy people. That's much more the strength of the arguments that we bring. I think why we do this, our podcasts and writing books and speaking, et cetera, is to broaden the conversation beyond the predictable tent. I'm old enough to remember when climate negotiations started way back before COP1, and there were about 100 of us in the room. And that was it, right? It was a very new topic. Very little had been written about it. You certainly couldn't get an advanced degree in climate change. And peu à peu, little by little, we have actually brought more and more people into the conversation to the point where we're beginning to mainstream this, right? We're beginning to take the topic to the kitchen table. And that is why I think that we are so intent on continuing to communicate, because this cannot be the responsibility only of those few policy people that you were mentioning at the beginning, Adam, right? Yes, their decisions are important, but this is actually an all-person, all-hands-on-board issue. And so we're both very intent about reaching beyond our tent and using new and fresh channels to communicate, which is why we had you and your brothers on our podcast, because you have a reach into a universe of audience that is completely beyond ours. And that makes a big difference.
So this segues perfectly into a little bit of the more in-depth talk that I want to have. You talked about bringing in all of these different audiences, and both of you have worked with corporations in different capacities. So Mary, in your UN capacity, you looked a lot at certain negative impacts from corporate actors on human rights. And Christiana, you're working with some of the biggest corporations in the world to engage them on climate change issues. So my question is, what is your process for speaking with and engaging corporations when there historically and even still has been so much damage, but we need them to join the conversation and there is so much potential?
It's true, Adam, when I started my work as High Commissioner for Human Rights, there was a small unit in my office which dealt with business as being on the wrong side. Business was bad for human rights, quite simply, full stop. And I actually accepted that this was largely true, but surely not completely true. And then we began a discussion with Kofi Annan about engaging the corporate sector. And he had this idea of corporations could be brought into a kind of link with the UN, and the Office of High Commissioner was part of that. But I was always questioning whether this was blue rinse, as we sometimes call it, you know, getting a link with the UN, but actually maybe being good on one thing, but not so good on a whole range of other things down the supply chain. And so I feel that was what the Office of High Commissioner was trying to do in those days. And it's the same thing with climate. It's engaging, but always being aware that the corporate sector needs to be held to account appropriately. Both Christiana and myself work with a wonderful group of business leaders called the B Team of Business Leaders, and they actually have impressed me. And I need, you know, a lot of impressing to be impressed. But they have actually impressed me with genuine steps in leadership. The first one was in January of 2015, before the Paris Climate Agreement, when the B Team committed to be net zero emissions across the board, not just carbon, but other emissions by 2050. And they did it. I was with them at the meeting that they decided it. And I remember saying to them, look, do you know what you're saying? This is going to be serious. And they said, well, there are laggards and there have to be leaders, and we want to be true leaders. So we will commit. And I remember, Christiana, because you had your job as head of the UNFCCC executive, and you were so pleased that this was real. I remember you saying that to me, this is a breakthrough, Mary. And we have stuck with that group, and I think they do give leadership, but I'm always aware of that need to take a view that the danger is that there will be some problem in the supply chain. And we can see that it could be, you know, importing cotton from the Uyghur province in China. It could be anything. And good companies, if they have that problem, and many of them do have problems, know how to deal with it. That's the important thing.
Yeah, I do remember how impressive it was, because now, 5 or 6 years later, you have just a growing and exploding growing number of companies committing to net zero by 2050. But that was really cutting edge in January of 2015. That was really totally cutting edge. And I was so grateful to all of you at the B Team, and I wasn't there at the time. I would also like to add that my attitude toward corporations has always been to reserve judgment and to not point a blaming finger as my introductory conversation with them, but rather to acknowledge that all of us have a past, all of us have done things that today we deem completely impossible and unacceptable. And I always like to give, especially corporate leaders, but also finance sector leaders, or politicians for that matter, the benefit of the doubt, to understand that we don't gain anything by blaming them for what they have done in the past, but we gain a lot by holding them accountable for what they're doing now. And that's the difference, right? It's not about pointing a blaming finger. It's about holding a mirror of accountability to what they're doing now, because now we have so much more information than we did 3 or 4 years ago. And of course, on climate, it's very much of an expectation of what they're going to be doing in the near future, because it is really about the next 9 years. And so there we hold very, very high expectations.
How do you form those expectations? Because we all know that greenwashing is such a big problem, especially on the public-facing side of corporations. So how do you, Christiana, when you are meeting with a corporation, say, okay, we need to see every single step along your entire supply chain of everything that you're doing to ensure that you are making these commitments, and it's not just the public-facing work?
Well, I actually personally don't go into those details. Luckily for both of us, there are many analytical organizations that go into those details. And the truth is always somewhere in the middle of all of these analyses. So, you know, in the best of all cases, you would have a company's decarbonization path being examined and reviewed by several organizations. They come up with somewhat different results. And then you know that the truth is somewhere in the middle. And for me, what is important is not perfection today, but the commitment to perfection tomorrow. And show me how you're moving in that direction. Don't just promise the paradise or the nirvana, but show me how you are moving in that direction. And that covers everything, right? That covers decarbonization, that covers labor rights, that covers gender equality. It covers the whole panoply. And the fact is that once a CEO wakes up to the responsibility of marrying purpose and profit together at the same level, they actually do understand that that needs to be across the board. They don't really choose, well, I'm just going to decarbonize, but I don't really care about gender parity. It's very seldom that you see that, because CEOs understand once they reach that level of, let's call it, corporate enlightenment, they understand that all of this actually not only fits together, but is mutually reinforcing.
Fantastic. So we've spoken a little bit about the corporate side of this. I want to talk a little bit about academia, because in the last 10 years or so that I've been studying these issues pretty intensely, I've seen a real disconnect between academia and activism. Mary, from your perspective, what can each side be doing better to help find this mutual respect and point towards a positive future, the two sides being the academic world and the activists?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I speak a lot to universities, and I try to impress upon them that they are thought leaders, that they must train young thought leaders to really think about the issues of our world. And they must get out of their comfort zone in doing that. And they must, I suppose, make more of a link with activism on the ground locally so that they will be better at what they're doing. So I think I'm trying to bridge that in a way. And I love to unpick what I mean by climate justice and the layers of climate justice. And in that context, try and open up space for thinking in many connected ways, intersected ways, about how climate justice brings together the many inequalities and injustices of climate change. So I'll run through them very quickly. The first one was the one I first came across working in African countries, that climate change disproportionately and much earlier impacts the poorest countries, small island states, indigenous communities. And these happen to be the black, brown and indigenous people. So there's a racial injustice that we're seeing more now because of COVID. Secondly, the gender injustice within that, the different social roles of women, the different ways in which they try to put food on the table in drought. They try to make their communities more able to cope with these problems, but without land rights, without access to capital, etc. The third is the intergenerational injustice that young climate activists have reminded us of and called us out on. The fourth injustice is a very subtle one, but an important one. The injustice of the different pathways to development. The industrialized countries, we built our economies on fossil fuel. Our obligation now is to wean ourselves off. But developing countries, and Cristiano will remember this, before Paris, many, many of them committed to go as green as possible. But they said, we will need the investment, we will need the training, we will need the skills. And we did not show enough solidarity in providing that. And the fifth injustice is the injustice to nature herself. The, you know, loss of biodiversity, the extinction of species. So those five seem to me to kind of be a really holistic way of addressing the issue. And I would love universities to almost plot their curricula around some of these issues in a way that also encourages their students to be active locally on these issues.
Christiana, your initial comment about the way that Mary can communicate about these issues is so spot on. It was so simple and clear and easy to understand. So thank you so much for that, Mary. Feel free to disagree with me on this, but I would love to offer a sixth one for you to consider. I would love to offer the fact that we know that reactions to climate change, specifically technological reactions and technological solutions to climate change, also have the potential to cause injustices. So as we're building the solutions, we also need to make sure the solutions themselves are not harming communities.
Are we stepping on PhD ground now, Adam?
We are a little bit stepping on PhD ground. But my next kind of area that I want to talk about is human rights and climate change. Christiane, I did want to give you an opportunity to respond, if you wanted to, about the academic disconnect between academia and activism. But if you like, we can move right along to
We can move on. I mean, Mary, I think, has done a beautiful job at answering that. And I would agree 200%.
So I kind of want to open up this question generally. Mary, you talk about climate justice. What is the relationship, first, between climate justice and human rights? Are they the same thing? And why aren't we using the terminology human rights right now to talk about climate justice?
Well, I find it a little bit difficult to answer because I use the human rights language all the time. Human rights and gender equality language all the time as part of fleshing out. I agree with your sixth point, so maybe we can come on to that. I agree that some of the solutions, particularly the commercial clean energy solutions, can often be part of the problem. And there is quite a bit of work being done on that, and I'm glad that your PhD, as I understand it, is somewhat focused on that, because it's very real. The problem is very real. There is a tendency to want to rush in with mega projects, and sometimes leaders of countries want mega projects because they want mega manufacturing. So they don't care about the problems on the ground. And this is very serious. I visited Honduras in my second mandate on climate change, which was climate change and El Nino in 2016. And Honduras is the dry corridor in Central America. And the drought was awful. And I talked to women who said, we have no water. How do you live without water? But they said, we have a very big hydro project quite near us. It has cut down trees. There are wires going to the city. We don't see any water. And another part of Honduras had a big solar plant. And exactly the same complaint from the community, supported by the World Bank, without thinking about the impacts on the ground and the lack of access of local people to the solar energy. It was all being channeled away. And over again, the Center for Business and Human Rights does a lot of work on this, and I'm very linked to that center. And I was quite shocked when I was told before Paris, and I remember telling this to you, Christiana, that we really have to be concerned about the way in which those putting in clean energy, if they don't think in terms of human rights, in terms of local traditions, local culture, indigenous communities, are likely to infringe on human rights, and that it was a growing and serious problem.
So what role do you believe indigenous communities should be playing? So yes, when corporate actors and state actors come in, they need to recognize that indigenous communities need to be engaged. But what role should they be playing in these kind of situations?
One thing that I have been very impressed by is the growing number of litigation cases that are coming to the courts and that have to do with human rights and climate change. There are, at my last count, but this is already several months old, 1,300 litigation cases that have been brought before either national courts or international courts, most of which are in the United States, interestingly, and most of them have to do with the human rights of vulnerable people. In this case, if it's a case against the state, it has to do with the protection of human rights understood as a protection from the negative impacts of climate change, not of the technologies of response, let's say. But I have been impressed that the legal system of the UN under the High Commissioner and when Mary was there, and certainly the current High Commissioner of Human Rights, totally recognizes the impact of climate change. And that has helped. For example, I live in Latin America in the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, totally recognizes the negative impact of climate on human rights of the most vulnerable populations. And so I have been actually quite heartened by the fact that those most vulnerable populations, who are, as we have already said, indigenous people, women and children, basically, or people with disabilities, basically the most vulnerable, there are so many independent organizations that are now bringing this to the attention of the courts on behalf of those people, because those people probably would not know how to present a litigation case. And as Mary has pointed out, they're actually struggling to feed and water their families. And so something that could be seen as esoteric, which is to bring a case to the courts, I think is a necessary part. It is not the only instrument, but it is a necessary pressure point for policy to move forward and for policy to be more inclusive and more open and responsive to especially the needs of the most vulnerable. So while I think on the one hand, it's important to see the cases on the ground and what is happening, it is equally as important to have a top-down strategy that pushes policy. And somewhere in the middle, we may find the right path.
And just to build on what Christiana was saying and pay tribute to your region, Christiana, there has just come into effect the ISCASU Convention, which is an extraordinary step forward for Latin American and Caribbean countries, because it not only recognizes human rights, it also recognizes the need to protect human rights defenders. And we haven't acknowledged enough that it's appalling to think of the number of human rights defenders who die or are displaced or their families are persecuted because they have defended the land rights, the water rights, whatever it may be, of their communities. And I think Indigenous peoples are doing incredible things around the world that we need to be listening to more. I have been so impressed by and learned so much from the contacts that I've had with Indigenous peoples. It began when I was High Commissioner. I realized I was the coordinator of the Decade of Indigenous Peoples. This was in day three, I think, of my job. And I said, oh, how many are there? And I was told, well, you know, more than 400 million. I think it's many more than that now. And I kind of said, what am I to do? You know, but I listened. The incredible sense of relationship with the earth, with living things. I mean, there is a wisdom there that if only we would take it on board, we will begin to live sustainably. I mean, I can't speak highly enough of what I have learned from my Indigenous friends and how important every lesson I learn is to me personally and to the world.
Absolutely.
One of my favorite examples of what you're talking about, the Dokis First Nation in Canada, in Ontario, they are an incredibly engaged First Nation. And so what they did was they took time to educate themselves about hydroelectric power. And so instead of having a company come in and say, okay, we want to build on this land, the Dokis First Nation have land use rights under Canadian law. And what they did was they interviewed many different hydroelectric companies. So they were the ones that got to choose which corporation that they were going to partner with, and therefore got to set the terms for human rights and sustainability.
Well done.
Yeah.
That's a great example.
Yeah. So more examples like that we need to elevate to show as examples that they have the ability to set the terms for how corporations can come in and provide not only sustainable energy sources for them, but also revenue sources from them. And the additional thing that this project did was it brought many of the Dokis First Nation back home to where they came from because people had left to go find other jobs. So now this new project on the ground allowed them to reconfirm their community. So it was an amazing example.
Wow.
One of the things that is obviously talked about a lot is the Sustainable Development Goals. And Christiana, you were talking a lot about law and how powerful law is. But there are still countries that, and like the US, I'm pointing the finger at myself, that have not ratified incredibly important treaties and conventions. The Sustainable Development Goals, even though they're not binding, were agreed to by 193 countries. Why do you think the Sustainable Development Goals have become so powerful that they're on t-shirts and sweatshirts and they're being shared on social media? Why is that something that people are engaging with so much?
Well, I would say two reasons for that. First, because the logo and, you know, all of the little squares was a brilliant job, I have to say, you know, brilliant marketing job. And I remember that conversation, right, when it was evident that we were going to have a whole bunch. Those of us at the UN were saying, nobody will be able to remember more than three. Who remembers more than three of anything? 17, forget it. And so Project Everyone, that was the PR company engaged for doing this, kudos to them, because they came up with this very, very brilliant way of visually expressing 17. That, and then it's open sourced, right? So everyone can use that, and we use it. I'm surprised Mary doesn't have a little SDG pin on her because she usually wears it. And I have my t-shirt and I have my, you know, my hoodie. And as you say, it really has become mainstreamed. So first, I don't want to jump over the brilliance of the job of Project Everyone. But then to content. I think the reason why we are gratefully bringing this to every kitchen table is because those 17 SDGs really encapsulate what we want. What we want for ourselves as humans, what we want for the planet, what we want for others, what we want for the oceans, for society. It is just such a beautiful expression of our highest ideals and our highest aspirations. And they're just incredibly inspiring because they bring together what all cultures and all generations and all genders and non-genders, what everyone actually really recognizes way deep down. Yes, that is who we want to be. You know, if we ever get a visitor from some other galaxy, or in fact, even from some other planet, we want to be recognized as the society that did the SDGs, as a society that actually implemented and achieved the SDGs. That's who we want to be as a human society. And it goes beyond socioeconomic differences. It goes beyond races, beyond genders, beyond national boundaries, beyond urban and rural. It just really hits who we are as human beings. And that is why I think that that has been so successful and that we all really identify with those 17 goals.
I very much agree with what Christiana has said, but sadly, COVID is undermining a lot of the progress that was made. We're slipping back. Girls are out of school. They're being pushed into early child marriage. There are many, many issues, the debt issue for developing countries and so on. So we will have to not only
rekindle. Come out,
yeah, absolutely rekindle. I was going to, yeah, and recharge hugely when we've come out of COVID in a way that's aligned with the Paris Climate Agreement.
And the SDGs, yeah.
Definitely. The number one question that I get when I'm out performing in front of crowds, when I'm giving talks, even on this podcast, is, do I really make a difference? Does an individual using a canvas bag as opposed to a plastic one, or a metal straw as opposed to a plastic one, or signing a petition or registering to vote, does that really make a difference? And is it worth taking my time? Or should we just leave it to the policymakers and the corporations and they will get the work done? So I'm curious from both of your perspectives how you would answer that question. I think I know how you will, but I want to hear.
I'll go first, if I may, Christiana, because I have a very clear idea here. I want every individual to take 3 steps in their life and to start now. And the first step is to make the climate crisis personal in your life if you haven't done that. And how will you know you've made it personal? Because you'll actually decide immediately to do something more strictly, to recycle in a different way, to have less waste, to change your diet maybe, something. And then you own the problem. You're part of moving forward. Secondly, get angry with those who have far more responsibility and aren't living up to it. And that's governments, it's corporations, it's cities, it's, you know, anybody with power who isn't using it well. The third issue, and this is the one that Christiana and myself love to talk about and nobody talks about enough, we have to imagine this world we need to be rushing towards. We're not doing that enough. We're not going to get there as urgently as we need to unless we actually want to. And of course we need to want to, because it's going to be a much healthier world. We're going to have lovely greening of cities. We're going to have these new jobs that are going to be so much better. We're going to hear the birds singing. We're going to have a more equal world. We can't get there fast enough.
Yeah, totally agree. And that list of 3 is one that Mary has successfully burned into my brain. And it's a wonderful list of 3. Does the individual make a difference? You know, it's a very interesting question, Adam, that we don't ask ourselves when we go to a team sport. We don't say, well, is the left tackle going to make any difference to the team? Is the right guard going to make any difference to the football team? We just know that each of them has their special roles and that it is as a whole and integrated team that they actually go into the game and win the game. We also, just to use unfortunately, a bellicose example, when people go to war, they don't say, well, is it going to make a difference if I go to war or not? When I walk down the beach in the morning here, and I walk or jog every day, and I'm always turning over these little sand dollars that are upside down, tummy up, on the beach so that they don't die in the sun. And I never ask myself, is this really important? This one single sand dollar, does it make a difference to the entire population of sand dollars, whether I save the life of this one or not? I don't ask myself that because I know that every single individual counts. Every single team player counts. Everybody in the army counts. Everybody counts. And so it's fascinating to me that when it comes to doing what we have to do for the SDGs, for the good of mankind, for the livelihoods, for the progress of human society, that we then all of a sudden ask ourselves, well, does it make a difference what I as an individual do? How come? How come we ask ourselves that and we don't ask the same question in very similar or analogous circumstances? So the answer is absolutely. What everyone does counts. And we can't afford to sit it out. This is not something that we can sit out. We all have to be in, all hands on board. Everybody has to be in and everybody has to do their major effort. Now, your effort and Mary's and mine are probably going to be different, right? Because we play in different games and different fields and all of us will be do different. But as a whole, we have to know that we're all working hand in hand. And only in as much as we all lean in, do we have a fighting chance of addressing this in a timely way.
On both of those inspiring notes, I know that you both are working on some incredible projects right now that I'm sure the listeners of this podcast would want to know more about and get engaged and involved with. And I know there are many different things. So if you each had to pick one of the things that you want the listeners to go and focus on right now that you're working on, where should they go and how can they get involved?
So I would like to recommend to everyone to go to Countdown, which is a partnership that we've started with TED. It's countdown.ted.com. And it's a very, very actionable list of what everyone as an individual can do. We have a list of steps that we call them, of what all of us can do in our daily life. Some are small, some are much larger, but we can start wherever we want to start. The point is to join the growing number of people who are consciously counting down their emissions. So countdown.ted.com.
And we'll put the links in the information so everyone can go find it. Mary, how about you?
Yeah, I don't have a kind of a direct involvement like Christiana in a kind of popular way like that. As chair of the elders, we try to speak out on issues of climate, COVID, inequality, and link the three of them. It doesn't have to be at that high level. Links can be made at all kinds of levels. So I would encourage linkage, but I don't have a popular one to offer.
I mean, you do have your podcast that everyone should be going to listen to.
Indeed.
Well, yes, they can listen to Mothers of Invention. It's great fun because I do it with a comedian, Maeve Higgins. She was 8 years old when I was elected president. And half the fun is she doesn't really respect me. She half respects me and teases me and jokes. And people love it, especially in Ireland. But people seem to just like it generally because it's funny, but it's also serious. And I've listened to Christiana's podcast. I haven't listened to yours before, Adam. I'll have to listen from now on. But I think podcast is a good way of communicating.
Definitely. As the very last thing before we end, I'd love to hear from each of you. Why are you optimistic about the future?
Well, I've learned from the first chair of the elders, not so much to say that I'm an optimist, but to say that I'm a prisoner of hope. And if you're a prisoner of hope, then the glass may not be half full, but there's something there that you work on. If not, then climate can be a sort of prophet of doom. It can be too big. It can be too impersonal. It can be too out there away from you. If you are a prisoner of hope, then you get hold of things and you make do with what you have and you make it work and then you have hope.
So, Adam, I am a self-defined stubborn optimist. And the reason why I think that is necessary is because, honestly, we don't have another choice. You know, to say this is too complex, it's too late, it's too difficult, whatever, is not a responsible stance. Because we just give up and we then let it go onto business as usual trajectory. And we know that that will lead us to human misery beyond anything we can possibly imagine. That is unacceptable. So I count myself as a stubborn optimist because we don't have another choice but to stand up now and do everything we can and bring together all our ingenuity, all our determination, all our stubbornness to actually make the difference that we have to make in order to build a better world. And I'm convinced that we can do it. I'm also convinced that we're not doing it fast enough, but I'm convinced that we can do it.
This has been incredible, and we've touched so many different topics, and obviously we could spend hours talking about any one of them. And just as much as the content of what we've talked about, I've really loved seeing the mutual respect that you have for each other and you continuing to lift each other up and support each other. So that just makes me feel so incredible. And thank you.
Well, wait. Let's get this straight. I polish Mary's shoes. That's the way it is.
No. I've learned as much from you as you have ever learned from me, Christiana. Don't you dare say otherwise.
Thank you both so, so much for your time, for your energy, for your work, for your passion, and for your excitement in all of these issues and today on the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks very
much.
And
good luck with your PhD. It's a great subject.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Thanks so much for listening. If you want to support this podcast, please visit sustainablepartnersinc.org/donate. Since we are a nonprofit, any little bit of funding helps us to bring you more episodes like this one. Today's episode would not have been possible without our amazing team. Producer and editor, Shelby Kaufman, and associate producer and engineer, Sophie Yu. I'm your host, Adam Mett, and thanks for listening to Planet Reimagined.